This holiday, BMW has reunited three members of the family at the BMW Roadhome Sales Event. The Agile X3, engineered for any adventure. The plug-in hybrid X5, commanding the streets with unmatched presence. And the all-electric i4, charging into the future with impeccable performance. Hurry in to find what powers your journey at the BMW Roadhome Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine.
Hurry in for exceptional offers through December 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
Good Tuesday afternoon and welcome into Grant and Danny. You are listening live to 106.7 The Fan. We will take you all the way up to 6:30 today. We will be with you tomorrow as well, and then we're off Thursday and Friday for Thanksgiving, so we will wish you guys the early happy Thanksgiving from us. And this time we actually, Thanksgiving's about to happen. We mean it. Unlike Dan Snyder, who just said it around.
He just said it in January.
2nd of February or whatever it was. That was weird.
It certainly was.
Chris Trapasso's on the show at 5. CBS Sports wrote a piece on the regression of Jaden Daniels. Dove in on the numbers to figure out what's wrong with the quarterback taking a step back. And Mateo Dunn joins us at 5:30. He is a school board member in Fairfax County. The decision was made yesterday by the principal at Hayfield to pull the team from the playoffs. Why now? How did this get so bungled and handled so badly? We'll talk to a member of the school board in Fairfax about the situation that swept the DMV coming up at 5:30 on The Fan. Daniel, you look good and refreshed.
Yeah, bring your brooms because it's a mess. That's where we're at with this Hayfield situation. Oh, buddy, I can't wait. Again, my barometer for have things crossed over from matters of sport to everyday life, I passed by three different pockets of conversation this morning at school drop-off about the Hayfield situation. Parents that don't care about sports, parents that do. Everyone in between had an opinion, a thought, a question, something to raise. I'm telling you, it's everywhere.
It's Tuesday, which means it's time for Grant and Danny's Commander Survivor. Every single week on this show, on Tuesdays throughout the football season, you vote at facebook.com/Grant and Danny. You can go vote right now. You kick one player off the island. You give one player immunity beyond the next game. We are whittling the roster down to just a half dozen players left for the Commanders when the dust settles today. Danny, who is left? And who can people vote on to send home or to give immunity to today?
Three on offense, three on defense. Quarterback Jaden Daniels, you might have heard of him. Probably not his best overall game. Statistically, ended up with pretty good numbers. A couple of touchdowns, a Hail Mary pick there at the end. But, you know, watching the game, I think maybe tells a different story. Austin Eckler, who left the game towards the end, again, with injury. Really, really scary. He won't be joining us today. Obviously, wishing him well. Want his recovery to be speedy. But, you know, wasn't, I don't think, had his best statistical outing. Terry McLaurin, who other than the 86-yarder was four catches for 16 yards, but he had the 86-yarder. Bobby Wagner, Frankie Louvell, who is immune this week, and Jeremy Chinn there on defense.
So Frankie Louvell is on to the next. He will be one of the five finalists in Commander Survivor in 2024. Otherwise, you could kick anybody off the island and you can give anybody immunity. I think Jaden Daniels, while it wasn't a great game, should probably be safe, right? But Louvell, Chinn, McLaurin, you know, there's some names on that list of guys who balled out and played really, really well. So it's getting tight now at this point. You did bring up Austin Eckler, and I do want to just say he will not be with us today. We will probably not catch up with him this week. Of course, he suffered what appeared to be a very serious concussion at the end of the game against Dallas on the final kick return. He gets slammed into the ground, lands on his head, and he was motionless on the field. Very, very scary scene. This is the part of football and the part of sports that is toughest. Now, we talk about enjoying covering sport and you and I having this game called a radio show and a job, right? This gig where we come in here and we talk about grown-ups playing kids' games. And it's pretty cool because we don't have to talk about serious stuff that really matters a whole lot in the grand scheme of the world. This is one of those avenues where it gets scary, and we are thinking about Austin. Hopefully he will be on the show early next week when he's feeling better, and hopefully he and his wife and family have a great Thanksgiving. So thoughts are with him
without a doubt.
He continues to recover.
It's the human element, right? Because it's very easy. You sort of are able to distance yourself from things as these guys are all wearing uniforms and pads and helmets, and you're just somebody that's up there. But when something like that happens, you're like, oh, yeah, there's a human being in there. right? There's a person with a family and loved ones and all that other kind of stuff. And, you know, it's very easy to watch the spectacle because that's what it is. It's they're modern day gladiators, you know, without the lions and things that you're seeing in the movie Gladiator or Gladiator 2. But that's what it is. It's for our incredible joy and amusement, the athletic feats that these guys put on, the amount of physicality just is incomprehensible to regular folks. And then when something like that happens, you're like, oh yeah, they're vulnerable, living, breathing human beings with, you know, full 360-degree lives that, like that, things can change. You know, whether you're watching the Damar Hamlin incident, Eckler, motionless on the field, it takes your breath away because you're reminded, oh yeah, there's a mortality to this. They're as fragile as anybody else.
Without belittling other injuries, whether that be an ACL or an Achilles or any of these other things that you see players suffer that are career-altering, awful setbacks where they've got to now go rehab in anonymity with nobody watching them for a year. There is just something different about the brain, I would say, in terms of, like, if a guy hurts their leg and they get carted off when their thumb's in the air and they're telling everyone, I'll be back, or even at the end of their career if they're not going to return and play again after that. That's sad and that's terrible, but that's one of those things that heals. Whether you get back to 100%, you're as quick and twitchy and explosive as you once were or not, eventually that's not going to be a problem. That's not going to be something that lingers into the future. There is a real fear and an anxiety, correctly, about brain trauma mm-hmm. in the sport. So when you see a guy who suffered a concussion against the Bengals suffer the concussion he did against the Cowboys, and I'm not a doctor, I can't tell you this one was worse. I just know that the optics were worse. This was not, you went down and you were a little jarred and you kind of walked to the sideline and he told us after, started feeling things a couple minutes after. This was, he's not moving, and immediately all the players are calling to the training staff mm-hmm. because he is laying lifeless.
It's that, oh no, right?
I mean, that's yeah. petrifying. We've yeah. seen it with Tua. We've seen it with other guys. That will never be an okay element of football. Mm-hmm. It is the worst part of the game that we all love, and so many of us, I'll speak for myself, are addicted to. I mean, it is an addiction. It is, you know, outside of my family, probably the thing I like most in life is getting to watch football, and it's the worst part of it.
Yeah, I think that's well said. It's the, you know, when you have to tear down that barrier or that wall, right, where these invincible supermen do so much, and then it's, oh yeah, that's right. There's that really scary element that they're able to compartmentalize and put out of their minds. Because as soon as he's off the field, it's like, okay, here we go, line him up again. Let's play next play time. Just really, really hard to get in that headspace.
What time do we want to do the annual Thanksgiving Day food draft tomorrow? I think it's important that we pick a time right now and we let our listening audience know when they need to be listening to hear us moving and shaking, navigating the board, Clary and Darius trying to get their hands on the sides they want.
Mm-hmm.
Tomorrow, four of us, four rounds, Thanksgiving Day food draft. I'm thinking 3:00, right on the nose, square number.
3 works for me.
But does anybody have any issues? Is there something I don't know about?
Is there conflict?
Docket tomorrow that will prohibit us from doing that? Darius, when should people tune in for the Thanksgiving Day draft?
I think 3:00 is prime time for us. I think that works out. Let's do it.
So that means by 3:03, Clary will have taken gravy, number one overall, for like the third straight year.
I was thinking green bean casserole. He was going to switch it up this year. That's at least what the rumors are out there on the Twitterverse.
Do you guys have a game plan yet, or is that something you plan on preparing tonight? Like, do you know right now, if you had to do a draft, would you feel good about it?
I could do it.
Do you have to sit down with your scouts and see what the 40 times were on some of the options?
We'll do our final prep because you want to be prepared with an A scenario, a B scenario, and then kind of, you know, free-for-all. Like, if somebody goes rogue and goes unpredicted, like, I've got a feel for the other teams around me.
Yeah.
Depends on what, because I also don't know where I'm picking yet. We can't.
So I traveled the country, and I've got my own reports I've written up on various food items. But we have not put our board together. So our tradition on my team is that the night before the draft, we sit down and we kind of argue. I mean, no, everybody knows. We get a hotel that night. We're not going home tonight, okay? Eventually, you're going and you're crashing on a hotel bed near the facility. But the board will be assembled after a bunch of arguing at the end of tonight. And then we'll be ready for tomorrow for the most important day in show calendar, the Grant and Danny Thanksgiving Day food draft.
Now, do you color code it to identify who's a commander and who's not?
Oh, I do, yeah. So what you're thinking of is the commander tag. We call that the Paulson tag.
Got it. Right.
And there are only a couple foods that get the Paulson tag every single year, and they're the same foods. So if you guys have been paying attention,
you'll know those foods.
There's not a whole lot of secrets on my draft board. You know what I'm coming for. You know what I want. You know what I don't want. Nothing's changed here. Every year, that's the one problem is we're drafting the same players. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
And I'm starting to learn your proclivity.
Sure. Like for it's the equivalent of are you a Big Ten lineman? I'm probably interested.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, are you an SEC wideout? I'm probably interested.
This GM's got a thing. He really likes undersized linebackers. So uh-huh. Who are twitchy, who he likes to move off the ball, you know? Clary, you have been the guy that has upset the apple cart, I'd say, most in these drafts the last few years. Very controversial decisions.
Yeah.
Do you plan on possibly playing it a little more straight tomorrow, or is all hell going to break loose?
I mean, in my opinion, I don't think all hell broke loose in the recent drafts. Okay. I do think we built like a really kind of solid foundation up front, and I think this year could be the year we really kind of move around the board a little bit and make some splash moves. So we're going to be interested in some trades, and that is a report coming directly from the guy who makes the picks. I am open for business.
Wow. Open for business.
Open for business.
He's looking for a deal. I know a guy, depending on the pick you get. I know. Who might come calling.
See? And I might come calling to you.
Yeah. So open for business, Clarity.
Open for business.
Who needs Adam Schefter when the source is right here?
Yeah, it just goes on the radio and tells you. He's Jerry Jones over there.
I don't need to be texting Rhino. He just gave away the business.
Jerry Jones went on 105.3 or whatever that station is in Dallas and said, we're willing to trade our picks.
So we're going to be giving them away. If you want to come steal from us, that's fine because I'm not competent. So give us a call.
Cannot wait for tomorrow. What I thought Clarity was getting at there, he's going full Nats on us. Mm-hmm. He's like, yeah, we've established a nice foundation. We've made some deals. We've got some kids, but we're not winning yet. This is the year where we start to invest some funds. Oh, wait, I'm being told.
Hold on.
The Nats aren't even players in the Juan Soto sweepstakes. You see this today?
Yeah, of course.
Soto has met with several ball clubs. He has received offers by way of multiple reports now from five different teams. Those teams are, stop me when you hear Nationals, okay?
Okay, here we go. I'll stop you.
So you're listening for Nationals. These are the teams that have made Juan Soto an offer. Soto, by the way, who has said he'd love to play in D.C., loves it here, best performance of his career right here in the nation's capital. You'd stand a reason you want to get in on those sweepstakes. You have zero payroll. You know who the highest paid National is on their payroll for this year? Luis Garcia, making $5 million. You know who the second highest paid National on their payroll is this year? I'll tell you. Just listen. K-Bert Ruiz.
Here we go.
Making $5 million. They're not paying anyone. If they want to, they can go get Juan Soto. Now, they don't want to. And we knew all along they weren't going to get Juan Soto, and we've tried to let everybody know that was not going to happen. But five teams are at least pretending to be in on Juan Soto by putting up their paddles.
He's pretending.
Here are the teams. The Mets.
Yeah, you knew that, right?
The Yankees. The Red Sox.
He's going to say Nationals in a second. I know he is.
The Blue Jays.
Okay.
One more. It is a National League team.
Oh.
So here you go.
The?
They did play in that Nats-Dodgers division series in 2019.
One played in that series.
Yeah. The Dodgers.
Damn it.
Mets, Yankees, Red Sox, Blue Jays, Dodgers.
Now, here's the thing. There's 25 teams that aren't raising the paddles because they know it's unrealistic. They know it probably doesn't make a lot of sense in terms of team building to pay somebody that much money. You could start doing that with every person that plays Major League Baseball if they cost more than 17 cents. Are they in on anybody? And the answer is no.
That'll be the big question.
No, they're not.
But look, it's football season. We're coming up on Thanksgiving. Washington's got a 7-5 team that could be playoff bound. So the Nats are getting a little pass on that. But I will just say as an aside that it is absolutely time for them to spend some money as an ownership group. And if they don't, fans, and that means you guys should be irate. Because to my knowledge, they're not lowering season ticket prices. It's not a cheap ticket to get. It's not easy to go navigate Nats Park, right? The baseball operations staff, led by Mike Rizzo, and this is Mark Shalaba and Mike DiBartolo, and you know that whole crew of guys that run that outfit, they have saved ownership's bacon with trade-driven efficiency in the rebuild. They're in a really good spot, actually, if they were to actually supplement with some star, major league, decent talent now. They're going to be interesting and middling as of right now, just based on the young core that they put together. But if they want to be good and competitive, they're three or four additions away, probably. And that's where ownership has to come in. And the payroll with Luis Garcia and K-Bert Ruiz as your highest paid players at this point is the tell. There's nobody on the payroll. They look like the Marlins or the A's, Danny, when you look up who they're paying. I mean, seriously, it's like Miami, Oakland, Washington. That's what it looks like.
Yep.
So the last few years of the rebuild, I'm on board. There's no reason to spend big. You're not blocking kids. You got to see who's good and who isn't. You got to give opportunities to your youngsters as they graduate. It's now time to do that. And if they don't, Nats fans, sports fans, people in this city should absolutely be livid. And frankly, the media needs to start, I'd say, beating the drums and sounding the bugles a little bit. Because if there's no pressure, if it's just this big, well, whatever, you know, it's okay. You know, they have a payroll of $40 million and they'll go out and they'll win 73 games. It's not okay.
No.
In the nation's capital.
No. And I understand how we got here. It's a lot of bad luck. A lot of things that's nobody's fault. Right? Global pandemic happens the year after you win the World Series. That changed things. There should have been a huge cash influx. The TV deal isn't necessarily anybody's fault. I understand how we got here. But my point is, we are here. Nobody's saying you've got to do what the Red Sox and the Yankees and the Dodgers do, which is print your own money and go crazy. What everyone, I think, is saying, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what I'm saying is, when you move on from Kyle Finnegan after not trading him, you just give him his walking papers. You could have got something back that's a human being. That's someone with a pulse. Maybe a shot at someone. If you're moving on from him because he's too expensive, you're going to get, and you're not going to fill that void. Like, all you're doing is being cheap. There's no longer there's a strategy behind it or whatever. Any type of move that's made simply to not pay somebody. It has nothing to do with being good, bad, or indifferent. If the move is, we can't afford Tanner Rainey. We were patient with that guy for a rebuilding team for years, for potentially this season, where he finally comes back, removed from Tommy John, etc., to be good, and he's gone because he might cost $1.7 million on arbitration. What are we doing?
On Finnegan, by the way, I think this is an important thing to hit. Kyle Finnegan is now a free agent. He'll be leaving Washington very likely unless they get him back, I guess, on a cheaper deal than they would have paid him. He was not set to be a free agent. This is very different.
Yeah, arbitration eligible,
If a guy is contracts ending and he's leaving in free agency, that happens. They opted to let him become a free agent by non-tendering him instead of paying him for another year on his contract because he was set to make upwards of, say, $8.5 million, $9 million, and they probably view him more as a $7 or $7.5 million player. And from a baseball perspective, they are right. The counting stats, 38 saves last year, don't really match the underlying numbers.
That would entitle them to a pay raise, and if their point is that's an overpay, I happen to agree, by the way. But I don't think that's crazy.
But they're doing the Nats math of, well, we got to spend $12 million this year, so let's free up $9 million from Finnegan, and now you're only really paying $3 million. Mm-hmm. That's Nats math. The math should be, is Finnegan a helpful, good reliever? Then who cares if you're overpaying him by $1.5 or $2 million? And if the Braves or some winning team that has a real payroll and has actual money being spent on players did what the Nats are doing with Kyle Finnegan, I would say that's really smart. That team gets it. I like that data-driven approach because they know he's not quite worth it. But when the Nats do it and you're paying no one, and then you say, oh, this guy at $9 million, probably $2 million more than we think he's actually worth, no, we'll save that $2 million, and we just won't pay him at all, and we'll let him hit free agency and reallocate the money. Forgive my skepticism. I'm not really sure if you reallocate the money. Again, baseball-wise, that's Rizzo and his group looking at this saying, this guy's not worth $9 million. They're not wrong. But if it matters that much to maybe be right on $2 million when your payroll
is zero outside of him,
nothing, we got problems here.
Right. I mean, to me, you know, and you might disagree with this, and I think that's fine, but I need an organization to know, hey, we don't think he's worth what he's going to get next year in arbitration, or we don't want to have the pay increase. There's a trade deadline. I know contending teams aren't going to go, he's worth, you know, I don't know, our third best prospect in the org, and here's a trade package that you would get for Juan Soto or for Trey Turner or somebody that's legit.
Oh, no,
I understand
that. No mistake about it. They botched it. They absolutely should have traded him in July. They screwed that up.
And that's kind of my point here. So if the baseball folks had any kind of communication with the ownership staff going, hey, this might cost us a little bit more, but he's a good guy to have. All he's ever done is the right thing here. He's consistent. He answers the bell every day. The metrics aren't probably worth what he's going to command, but there's worth having somebody that's done the right thing because the organization rewards someone. If ownership goes, you know what, it's probably too rich for our blood, we could better allocate elsewhere. Now I know that, and I can do a baseball move where I can trade this person for something else. I have no problem. Instead, they have nothing, and they're going to fill it with nothing.
Correct.
That's everything about that's wrong. I'm so upset about it. All I've wanted to do for days is scream about it.
Yeah, and I'm glad that we are. Also, it makes me worry that the communication from ownership to the front office either wasn't there at the deadline or has shifted.
Mm-hmm.
Like maybe they didn't know in July that they were going to have so little to spend. And now they need the $9 million that you free up with Finnegan so that you can spend elsewhere because you're not getting what you thought you would get. I mean, these are all my own theories. I don't know that I can back any of them up. But what I know is it's been a long time since they've spent any real money. That's what I know. And that they're in a pretty good spot because they've got a savvy front office that's made a bunch of really good trades. If not for that, they'd be one of the dregs of Major League Baseball. And it is time to open up that checkbook and to spend some money this offseason. Next, though, let's get to the Commanders. What is the biggest reason for their three-game skid? They've gone from 7-2 to 7-5. What is the biggest reason for those three straight losses? That's next on G&D.
You know, it's crazy. That's fine because, like, we didn't really need, like, we didn't need nobody to believe in us from the beginning. Like, nobody ever did. So, you know, it's always been about, you know, proving the haters wrong. You know, it's okay. You know, we know we've been playing bad, you know, bad ball. And, you know, we know how to play good ball, you know. So it's all about, you know, doing that, you know, simple as that.
Running back Brian Robinson, as heard on the Junkies earlier today, right here on 106.7 The Fan. Welcome back to Grant and Danny. Commanders back to being able to put their backs against the wall and kind of play the card of them against the world. Nobody's believing in them. You can't do that when you're 7-2 and your quarterback's an MVP candidate. But after three straight losses at 7-5 and now with folks jumping off of the bandwagon as far as them headed to the playoffs, you hear Robinson suggesting, hey, we're back where we started. We're comfortable here. Danny, what's the biggest reason for them having lost three straight? That is the question. We will open up the MGM National Harbor listener lines for you guys to answer that question at 800-636-1067 right now.
Lack of talent. I actually think that's true on both sides of the ball. But to me, scheme will get you so far. In other words, the design of a schemer or the plan of a schemer is to basically go, I'm going to get Grant Paulson one-on-one with somebody. That's the best you can hope for, reasonably. Sometimes you get somebody unblocked. Sometimes you get someone running free. When that happens, that's great. That's great design, great everything. But eventually, you have to win. And as teams get tape on you, as other coaches and other programs figure out what your tendencies are, what you do and what you don't, there's got to be a time when your guy can beat their guy. And that has run out. Their second-best receiver was cut by a competitive team. That's where we are. In terms of the secondary, they got a guy that was drafted to be a slot corner that's been their best corner all season long playing on the outside. Nothing wrong with Mike Sanders, by the way. I love the kid. But
he's going to be a great player for a long time.
He's really good. But the design was to have him be your number three, right? Your slot corner. And he's been basically their ace. Now, hopefully, Lattimore comes and helps everything and everybody kind of slots down more, you know, in a more appropriate place, but they lack elite pass rush. They lack dominance on the defensive line. They're probably not unbelievable at safety. Like, to me, they're under-talented, and scheme has covered for a lot of it. And now that you get in some adverse situations, which is going to happen in football, you lose some of the turnover luck that you've had. You know, adversity strikes. On your third and nines, your guys can't win. People play man against you. You can't separate. You punt. That, to me, is what's happened. The lack of talent in a lot of spots. And I understand it. It's year one of this rebuild. They're trying to turn over the roster. Usually what happens is what happened to Ron Rivera. You're pretty much garbage in the first year after the old regime when you're cleaning stuff out. Here, this clean out has got them into a playoff race. I'm not complaining, just simply observing. When you leave $100 million cap space on the table, when you're not signing guys long-term, when you're not trying to transform everything overnight, things don't transform overnight, sure, usually to this degree. So it's more of an observation as to where they are, but I think it's finally caught up with
them. Yeah, they didn't really have 12-win talent. and they were on their way to 12 wins.
Yeah.
And a regression's happening. But that doesn't explain away why they couldn't finish when they were up 10 against Pittsburgh, or why when they had a chance to take the lead in the fourth quarter against the Eagles, the game went the way that it did, or why you have a letdown game because they got plenty of talent as it pertains to beating Dallas, right? I mean, individually, like, that makes sense when you're in the hot air balloon looking down at their season from several thousand feet up, but that doesn't work for me game by game. And game by game, how we actually got here with the three straight losses, to me, this is, there's a bevy of issues. You could make a list of probably 10 to 15. The biggest one for me when I look at all the numbers is third down on offense. I think on offense, they have a third down problem right now. If you compare their three-game losing streak to the Cincinnati game when Jaden Daniels was the best he's been all season long, it's a pretty substantial juxtaposition, right? In the Cincinnati game, they averaged third and 4.3 over the duration of the game. In the last three games, they've averaged on third down needing 7.3, 6.3, and 6 yards.
Mm-hmm.
It's at least a 2 to 3 yard difference. That is massive. Against the Bengals in that game, where Daniels was amazing, they had two plays of third and 7 or more. In the Steelers game, they had 8 plays of third or 7 and more. They had 7 plays of third or 9 and more. They didn't have a single one of those against the Bengals. 0 plays, third and 9 plus. They have had 7, 2, and 3 of those, so a total of 12 in this three-game losing streak. So the issue, I think, largely is a lack of efficiency on early downs. They're not ahead of the chains. They are in second and long too often. In fact, I saw a piece in the Washington Post suggested that they averaged second and 8.1 this past week against the Cowboys, which was second worst on second down for what they needed to get all season. That same piece cited a stat on third and long that Sam Fortier wrote, converted third and long opportunities. Their rate up until the three-game losing streak was 36%, which would have been the best in the NFL in the last 2+ years. The last three games, they're at 11%. So they've fallen off by almost a quarter of what they were doing earlier, and this would be worst in football. So they've gone from the best on third and long in the NFL over 2+ years to the worst. And the truth eventually will be in the middle, but this is the correction that we all knew was coming. You can't convert 36% of third and longs. That's not going to happen. And when you start not doing that, you start punting, which they weren't doing, the no-punt offense. 17 punts in their first 8 games, 17 punts in their last 3 games. So I think, Danny, the biggest problem is on first down, they're not winning enough. Second down has not gotten them to third and short. In that Bengals game,
mm-hmm.
do you know that their first 4 third downs were third and 1?
I remember they felt short. I didn't know they were all third and 1. Yeah.
Third and 1. Like, do you know how easy it is to operate offensively if you're constantly in third and 1?
That was the theme first half of the year, is they're doing that
incessantly, and they're not anymore.
100, so that's documented. That's correct. That's inarguable. And I guess where you and I differ is why that's happening. I think everyone's on to the scheme. I think everyone's on to...
Why do we differ?
Well, I think it's a talent problem. Like,
Have I said I disagree with that?
Well, when everybody... That's how you started your soliloquy. But either way, to me, the word is out. It's been solved. There's no wrinkle. There's no counterpunch. There's no different, set a bag of tricks here consistently to get teams off of what they're doing. Dallas concocts a great pass rush, and Washington has no idea what to do about it because their scheme says, X, we chip the edges, and this is how we chip the edges. Well, they go, fine, we're not going to have any edges. We're not going to bother with that. We don't care. And there was no answer to it. I think that's a theme of what's going on here. And to me, it comes down to the guys, the line, where we're going, these guys are amazing. They're way outperforming. They're now getting mauled and pushed around. Now, you go up against good players. Jalen Carter had a week, had a month last week against Washington. Pittsburgh's had a bunch of guys that are outstanding up front, too. So, okay, maybe it's that. Well, now Dallas is a bunch of bums that are looking to quit that threw you around, too. And you go, oh, okay, maybe one-on-one, we're not good enough anymore. And everybody's kind of onto it, and they're almost getting a head start with what you want to run and how you want to run it. So they're behind the sticks constantly, it feels like.
Yeah, I agree with you on the talent at certain positions, for sure. The areas where it was pretty obvious in the offseason, you know, where we're not breaking any news to say when you're starting a wide receiver that was the number 5 in Houston, probably need some help there, right? I don't think the O-line is nearly as bad as everybody thought coming into the year, and I would point to kind of how this year has gone as evidence of that. But they are on my list right now, mm-hmm. just because they're so banged up. Like, we can say, oh, they didn't play well enough against the Cowboys, and you're out there just like Jaden Daniels, right? We can make the excuse of the rib or not, but there's an expectation when you play that you can help.
Yeah.
Tyler Biadasz has come on and off the field, and I've watched him on two or three straight home games go back to the locker room for treatment while the defense is on the field. Like, I don't know what's going on with him, but he's not 100% healthy like he was early in the year.
Yep.
Andrew Wiley missed games, missed another couple of quarters this past week, replaced with Trent Scott. They haven't had Cornelius Lucas, who was a starting left tackle at the beginning of the year, big part of the rotation. So you're talking about multiple tackles and your center being on and off the field. Allegretti has been kind of in and out a couple of different times this year. So I do think they are banged up on the O-line for sure. And the other thing is, while we're talking about maybe a lack of talent or execution or whatever with pass catchers, they're dropping more passes.
Yep.
They did not really drop passes early in the year. Through their eighth game, they had three drops. Over the last month, they've got 10 drops. That's according to PFF. But if you watch the game, you feel like it's probably
even more than that. It feels like
more than 10. That's just the statistical, like, receiver-friendly version of how they grade drops. But that's a big deal. And they were not dropping anything early on. That was coming. Again, there's just going to be a correction. There's going to be a regression to the mean. But they've gone even beyond that. It's like, you know, three or four drops here or there you're banking on. When it's six,
right? Now you're going, when it's okay, three times that, yeah.
Maybe settle down.
And same thing with turnover luck. They had incredible fortune, and now some of that's run out where they're turning it over at three times. They were record-setting, for God's sakes, through 9 weeks with a rookie quarterback. It doesn't happen with veteran quarterbacks, let alone a rookie.
A lot of what was happening was unsustainable, and we knew that.
Mm-hmm.
And the correction has come loudly, and it's all kind of at once. But it's even swung back further than I anticipated. You know, if it swung back and you lose to the two really good teams and you beat the Cowboys, that makes sense. But to go out and play the game against Dallas that they did is pretty shocking. But let's hit the calls on this next at 800-636-1067. You hear what Danny thinks. You heard my point. Where are you guys at on this? Why have they lost three straight? What's the biggest reason for it? You're locked into the Fan. With Danny, I'm Grant. You're listening to The Fan. Coming up at the top of the hour in 12 minutes, our fastest 16 minutes in football will recap every single game in the NFL from this weekend. 5 o'clock, Chris Trapasso of CBS Sports wrote about Jaden Daniels' decline in his performance since the first 5 or so weeks of the season, and he was trying to drill down on what has led to that stepping backwards. We'll have him on the show at 5 to dive into some of the numbers he found. But the question for you guys right now is, what's the biggest reason for Washington losing three straight games? Danny says lack of talent. I'm drilling down even deeper. In-game, I think they are not operating well enough on early downs, and it's third and long too often. And that sets you up for failure. And they were kind of playing with fire early in the season and getting by. Like, that's just inevitable. You can't eat fast food every day and not gain weight. If you keep doing that, eventually you'll be an age where you're going to gain weight, and they got there. Let's go to Elijah in D.C. What's up, Elijah?
Hey, buddy.
What's going on, fellas? You kind of hit the nail on the head. This first down thing is a big deal, and I think they have to get this first down worked out. I think the system requires Jaden Daniels to be dynamic on every play, which I think in itself isn't necessarily sustainable. Not that he isn't dynamic, but it just puts in a situation where he's going to have to do a lot. You saw that drive when they did an excellent job, and it was basically because he was moving his leg, which is cool, but it seems like the defenders, especially at the linebacker position, have changed their angle of pursuit on him versus trying to get to the sideline versus darting straight at him. You see, he does a little spin and he gets down. They've noticed that if you give him room, he's different than a Lamar Jackson. You don't want to run at Lamar the same way. When you run at Lamar, he responds differently, you know. So I just think it's a few things that first down has to be worked out, and you have to get more creative with moving 17 around.
I love that phone call. Appreciate it. He said something that jumped to me and it reminded me of something. It's been hard to quantify this, but it does feel like, I know it's not the same scheme, same everything, but just bear with me. It feels like early season Bears, where you're basically going, All right, Caleb, do something incredible, buddy. We got some players for you, but it's up to you, really. It's felt like that a little bit lately. And when you play good defenses, you can't really get away with that for four quarters. Now, the Dallas one, I can't quite explain, but that's kind of been my feeling of late, where I think the caller said it best. When that first down run, that's not Jaden Daniels' fault that it goes for 1 yard, but now you're kind of going, all right, dude, be Superman, and that's not a fair ask to anybody.
So I'm looking at the first five third downs of the game this past week against Dallas. Third and 12, third and 7, third and 2, third and 7, third and 9. Four of them 7 or more.
Yeah.
Two of them 9 or more. What is, how to make sure you don't sustain drives for 500, Alex? Right? I mean, that you just, you can't live that way. Chris Oxon Hill, what's up? You're on Grant and Danny.
Hey, how's it going, fellas?
Buddy.
Definitely appreciate y'all taking my call today. I feel like I kind of agree with you, Grant, where it's like, you know, I think that the offense isn't gelling right now. I feel like really honestly that they're not 100%, especially I don't think that Jaden has recovered fully from that Panthers game with the rib injury.
How do you say that and watch him run for 75, his third highest total this past week? He was every bit as explosive to me. He looked like the same guy from the Bucs game on Sunday against Dallas.
Well, the reason why I kind of feel that way is because I feel like he hasn't been as explosive as he was prior to when we were on that that nice seven-game, you know, win total.
Even this weekend, you didn't think?
Yeah, I thought he was back to that this weekend. You didn't?
Well, this weekend, I would say, if I had to grade him a scale of 1 to 10, I would say he was at least about a 7.5, because I felt like there were some things that the offense didn't do that they have done in the past that look good. For example, Noah Brown, like you mentioned, Noah Brown has been passing a lot of balls, and the thing is that he's normally pretty good with his hands. So that's one aspect that I kind of go towards, where I don't put all the blame on Jaden. So if it's sounding like I'm trying to blame Jaden, no, that's not what I'm trying to do.
But you know, I didn't take it that way. Appreciate the phone call.
So there's a difference between how he played versus how he looked physically. That's what Grant and I were talking about. I think, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but to me, I kept saying the same thing over and over the last couple weeks, where I'm like, he just doesn't look explosive, twitchy, quick, you know, gliding around the way he did early in the season. And I thought he did this past Sunday. I think that's now more conventional. That's kind of, I think a lot of folks feel that way. Yeah?
I 100% agree. He looked more twitchy than he had. But I don't think the rib was as big an issue from a passing standpoint over the last few weeks. It's part of why he was in the pocket more, I think. And we saw that. Like, he looked different, more explosive. He ran 7 for 74 this past week. But I don't think it really affected him as a passer. And my bigger issue, frankly, has been that part of it over the last few weeks. Not that he has been bad, but the passing game has been bad. He's obviously a part of that. Let's go to Nate in D.C. What's up, Nate?
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good, buddy.
Good, good. I think this little scare, for one, I think we were lucky to only have lost five games thus far. We had the luck of doing some very a little more simplistic defenses, but recently, I mean, the team has had the unfortunate opportunity to play some of the top NFL defenses. This was Jaden Daniels' first look at them. It was the entire team's first time playing against these type of defenses and coaches like a Tomlin. And then Jaden and company got the opportunity to be able to witness one of the most intense rivalries in sports, even though as Commanders and / Redskins, we've been on the losing end of that rivalry for much of the last 25 years. He was thrust into some very unfortunate situations, and don't look now, but the Tennessee Titans have a very tough defense. So.
Yeah, they're top five.
Totally, yeah, they can play.
I don't think there's anything about Washington and Dallas at this point that feels different when the game starts as a player. I don't think those guys, they're not seeing that navy blue and the Cowboys and going, man, we got to win this game. They're not playing differently or harder. There's not any more animus. You know, they've had chippier games this year a couple of times over. So I don't think it was like, man, he wasn't ready for the rivalry or something. I don't think that is tangible or necessarily a real thing. People want to weigh in so we can take your calls on this. What's the biggest reason for the three-game losing streak? 800-636-1067. Also, Jaden Daniels has a tendency when it comes to where he throws the ball on the field. And I think that that is particularly important based on where Cliff Kingsbury lines up Terry McLaurin. So I looked some of this up last night. I think this data is really interesting. I think you guys will want to hear this. We'll get to that next right here on The Fan.